Hello and welcome to the EUISS podcast, a conversation on foreign policy what-if scenarios. My name is Florence Gaub, I'm the host of the show, and with me today is Stanislav Sekriru, our man on Russia. Hello, Stanislav.
Hi, Florence, and thank you for the invitation. Glad to be on board.
Nice, of course, to have you here. And to you, the audience, so today we're going to do something a bit different. In our past episodes, we always looked at what-if scenarios ahead. But this time, we're actually going to look back. Why do we do this? Because if you want to get good at foresight, you have to review your past assessments and then you learn from them. So in this episode and the next two, we will look at major failures in foresight, basically where our expectations differed wildly from reality. In this episode, we will look at Russia. Now, if you were still too young at the time or you can't remember, in the 1990s and the first decade of the 2000s, these were the expectations on Russia. And let me quote, because I have gathered quite a few here. In 1999, Foreign Policy wrote that whoever comes after Yeltsin will be exactly like Yeltsin. If you don't remember Yeltsin, he was the first president of post-Soviet Russia. And also, if you don't remember him, it means he was not at all like Putin. In 2000, the year after, the US National Intelligence Council report Global Trends predicted that in 2015, Russia will be weak politically and economically. There's another book that came out in 2003, which said that by 2015, Russia would have converted its foreign reserves to the euro. Would you believe it? And a year later, we have, another quote here saying that the Russian leadership will continue to struggle, which means that it will preclude Russia from achieving great power status in the near future. I know that you also have a quote from the Wall Street Journal, Stanislav. Do you want to bring that one here?
There was a quote from Thomas Graham, who wrote a piece and later turned into the testimony on Russia. And he said that we are about to see the dramatic reversal of historical proportions, which probably will mean that Russia will be less of a subject of a geopolitical struggle, but more of an object of geopolitical struggle. And we have to contemplate the world without Russia.
And then, of course, fast forward, none of this happened. Russia never converted its foreign reserves to the euro. The ruble is very much standing. It not only continued to not be just, an object of foreign policy, it's very much a subject. It interfered in other countries. It occupied parts of other countries. When would you say the reality check between these expectations and the reality started? What would be the date?
The easy answer would be somewhere between a Munich speech in 27 and Crimea's annexation in 2014. The longer, more complex answer, I would say that it was a long process which started more or less with arrest of oligarch Khodorkovsky, and then Russia privatized or retook his assets with a loan from China. This was the first significant cooperation between Russia and China, and China helped Russia at that time. And then I would say after the speech in 2007, it was a Russian war against Georgia in 2008. And it sort of continued and spilled over into what we've seen in Ukraine and later in Syria in 2015. So I would say it was a continuous process. There were some events which marked this transition, but I think it was a sort of continuation from 2004 up to 2014. So basically one decade, which showed that Russia was able to reverse a couple of trends, not completely, but to reverse them and to build on the new strengths.
It's interesting that because now that I was listening to you, I also remembered that in the summer of 2013, when the chemical weapons were used in Syria, Russia played a completely different role than it does today. It was a mediator and people thought of Russia almost like a, preserver of peace and multilateralist, et cetera, et cetera. So it's true that it was a gradual process. It wasn't just bang in 2014, suddenly the world woke up.
And then it's important thing. It's not only what Russia was able to do, but what West allowed Russia to do.
Aha, now we are ready in the debate.
Yes. This is what you say about Syria. US allowed Russia to play this game because initially it was the plan coming from American congressmen.
We'll come back to this question of what's our role in all of this. But first, I would like to ask you, why did we get Russia so wrong at the time in the 1990s and 2000s?
Because we had the wrong expectations.
Okay. And what were they based on?
Well, they were based on the projection of trends which we've been observing unfolding in Russia, sometimes from the late Soviet Union, but sometime in the 90s. It's about economic decline. It's about demographic decline.
Let's talk about the economy, because I know that now when we go even further back in history, in the 80s, before the Soviet Union collapsed, we had the other problem, which was that people overestimated Soviet power and then suddenly woke up in 89 to find that the economy had actually eroded the system. So is this what happened afterwards, that people learned from the 80s and thought, okay, it's all about the economy and therefore Russia must be weak?
Well, it's true that Russian economy in late Soviet Union, Russian economy was in bad shape, you know. But what happened with Russia, it was a double transition. Transition from the state-dominated economy to privatized economy or to market economy. And these unleashed constructive and destructive forces. So basically, there were agents which profited of this transformation, like oligarchs or organized crime, who were challenging the authority of central government. And second thing, what happened in the 90s is that Russia was borrowing a lot from the West. And it created the impression of, exaggerated impression of Russian continuous weakness. We will continue to rely on the loans from the West. And on these assessments, we thought that we will be continuously weak. But fast forward in 2000, Russia managed to repay all the loans and to build the sovereign fund and to deleverage.
And why were they able to do this so much faster than people thought?
Because we didn't expect the high oil prices. And second, we didn't expect a more prudent macroeconomic policy. So they controlled the better inflation and they made the reserves, which helped them to weather the financial crisis in 2008-2009, which helps them a bit to minimize the effects of the sanctions from 2014. And it helped them as well when oil prices again collapsed in 2015.
So the economy recovered, you say, by the early 2000s?
Economy recovered through 2000s rapidly, and the Russian economy was growing much faster, at faster pace than the global economy.
It's an interesting point, because I think that, if I understand correctly, okay, it was doing better than we thought, but was it actually doing as well as a lot of people think a great power needs to do? Because I don't think it does. I don't think... I mean, in our we had a podcast with Yanis Kluge where we talked about Russian economy. It's doing better than it did in the early 2000s, but by all means, it's not China, it's not the United States, it's not Germany. I mean, it's not an economy. I think they're punching above their weight in a way, if you want. And I think this is perhaps an interesting insight into strategic culture, that many people in the West thought Russian foreign policy will be determined by its economic firepower, even now.
I think this was the sin we committed in the late 90s. When we too much focused on the economic resources and we neglected the political will of leadership to use the minimal resources we have to punch above its weight. And this is what is happening. Today, Russian economy is not the most developed and not richest economy in the world. At the same time, what we have seen, especially from 2014, is a determination to use minimal resources which Russia has in order to achieve strategic advantages. We generate even more strategic advantages. And again, I'm coming back to my previous remark. West allowed Russia to do what they were able to do with minimal resources in Syria. The same happened in Libya. And it's curious that it was not the West who stopped Russia. It was Turkey who stopped Russia in Syria and in Libya in 2020.
So are you saying that Russia sees these vacuums, if you want to put it that way, that were left behind, but they still seized them. And I don't think that anybody expected them to do that, which brings me back to this, perhaps not understanding Russian strategic culture, Russian interests. I'm not quite sure how to put it.
Yes, it's true. I think we very much in the West were trying to define for Russia what is in the Russian interests. And based on our definition of what is in Russian interests, to anticipate their behavior. We didn't practice the strategic empathy when you put yourself in the shoes of other actor and you try to look through his eyes the world around and to anticipate how he might behave. And this is the case, for instance, how we regarded Russian possible relationship with China. We assumed by default that Russia would like with us to counterbalance rising China. And we never even tested the alternative that Russia might do a bandwagoning with China and even try to counterbalance with China the West, what we've seen actually over the last couple of years.
One aspect that is related to the economy, because we're still in the why, you know, why didn't we see? So we have now two things. We have extrapolation from trends, perhaps extrapolating from the past, not understanding strategic culture. What about the military? Because I get the feeling that the Russian military, until perhaps even only recently, was always read under the lens of economy, how much money is spent on it. Is that perhaps also part of the problem?
True. We had two assumptions, that Russia doesn't have resources to restore the military capabilities. Second, there was no political will to do it. But because military was involved in the domestic political crisis in 1993, and maybe a political leadership didn't want to have a strong military in the first place. But what happened is that first, high oil prices solved one problem. It generated a lot of money, which were invested in the military procurement program. Second, the war in Georgia and the lessons Russian military learned there generated political will to conduct drastic military reform, the result of which we have seen in Crimea and in Syria. It's not Soviet army, massive, it's a light army, but it has a higher level of readiness, mobility, and capacity to conduct small operations. And then I think where we were surprised is that we didn't expect Russian army to be present far, far abroad. So, you know, this Russian concept of near abroad. And the assumption was that if Russia will use army, it will be in the near abroad.
Can you elaborate on this near abroad?
Yeah, I mean, it's a concept from the 90s when Russia was looking to define its policy towards former Soviet republics, and they coined the term near abroad, which is a code word for Russian privileged sphere of influence in the post-Soviet region. And they distinguish even in the gas contracts for near abroad and gas contracts for further abroad. This is the Europe and Turkey. So it's an interesting differentiation, not only in military affairs, but also in commercial affairs.
So we thought, well, based on that, we thought that Russia's strategic vision is post-Soviet space and then maybe us and Turkey. And we thought the rest of the world doesn't exist really for Russia.
Exactly. And what we've seen over the last, I think, 5 years, is amazing activism in foreign policy. It's not necessarily means that Russia is back to Cuba, Venezuela, as the Soviet Union was, or that it's back to sub-Saharan Africa with the same footprint. But Russia tries to play on the small presence and to exaggerate the influence it has in the region. Second, it tries to leverage back to the relationship with Europe and the United States. So by creating some troubles, Russia tries to bring us to the table, to talk to them about the problems which they are really interested.
Okay, now we're on the point of ourselves. How are we part of this? Would you say that because we believed that Russia was not going to have geopolitical ambition, that we created the problem in the first place? Or are we part of a larger thing?
I think we left ourselves exposed to surprises and unprepared for surprises. What happened, we underestimated the expertise on Russia we had, and we didn't invest to prolong it. And many people were switching from Russian studies or from Russian expertise to MENA or to other regions, China, for instance. We lost the expertise. Second, we underestimated the political effects of what we assumed to be economic positive interdependence, which we developed with Russia by trading more, importing oil, importing gas. While Russia exactly looked from a different perspective at the economic interdependence, they looked at it as a lever against us, which they actually used through the 2000s against Europe. And I think the third thing, we, from military point of view, focused on the operations out of area, but neglected the collective territorial defense, because we thought that Russia is not anymore a problem and cannot be a problem in the future. And I think the fourth thing where Russia managed to surprise is to project threats which cannot be stopped physically on the border. and I mean digital space. We managed to build on our vulnerabilities and that our economies are much more interconnected digitally than the Russian economy. We are more vulnerable to cyber attacks than Russia currently, because we so much rely in our e-governance, e-economy, e-health on digital solutions.
Which is interesting, by the way, because the hybrid method is something that Russia has very much, I'm not going to say invented, but really, really built up. And this is an element of innovation that, you know, when we looked at the Russian defense posture of the 90s, we really didn't expect Russia to innovate in any defense shape or form. And now they have actually managed to create a level of conflict mechanism, if you want to put it that way, that is just below the threshold of conflict. So we can never really get them in en flagrant délit, but they can still do damage.
Yeah, you know, Russians used to say that all the new is a good forgotten old. And this is the case of hybrid threats. If we go to Bolshevik Russia through the 30s, we can see a lot of examples how they experimented with influence operations, how they experimented with invasion without claiming that their troops are there under disguise. So they've been conducting this type of operations through entire Soviet history. Indeed, new technologies help them to be much faster and make this operation less costly. On our side, we forgot about these operations. We forgot the history. And that's why we have sometimes to go back to history and to reinterpret it and to put into the new context.
Although, as we have seen, if you're too close to history, if you look at Russia thinking it's the Soviet Union, you will not see the right thing either. So my question to you is really, what can we learn from all of this? What would you say? Well, let's start with the first question. If we had understood Russia more accurately in the 90s and the 2000s, what do you think we would have done differently?
You know, it's very slippery road, counterfactual
yes.
history.
Counterfactual history. This is a safe space.
Yeah. I think, first of all, we would have a different take on our capacity to transform Russia.
What would we have understood? That we don't have the capacity?
No, we would be more realistic, but at the same time, we probably would try to limit Russian attempt to change us through exporting corrupt practices in business deals, which we have been concluding with European companies. The second thing, we would pay much more attention to military contingency planning. Third thing, I think we would have to take much more seriously first Russian cyber intrusions conducted in the 90s, as we did at that time. And I think we would have a bit more humble attitude. We would not assume that we constantly will be the leading or powerful actor, but we would question whether we will continue to be preserving the dominance, whether we will be the one who dictate the trends.
I think this is and echoes a little bit what you said earlier about our own role. I think it's fair to say that we were lacking, and we probably still are lacking, self-awareness. It's easy when you sit on the inside, you are on the inside and you don't really see perhaps how others perceive your own role. How was our behavior perceived in Russia in, let's say, the 90s, to early 2000s? Were we seen as arrogant?
First, just to tell you that I think our mistake was that we considered the scenario world without Russia. We never considered the scenario world without West.
Yes, I'm sure others have.
Yes. I think through the 90s, the perception in Russia changed towards the West. I mean, initially, it was very enthusiastic. There was a lot of hope that there will be a lot of assistance. There will be very fast transformations, political, economic, and Russia will be accepted sort of in all international structures. But then these painful political transformations generated a lot of resentment, which we've seen more in 2000s and later coming up. And it came in the form that you came, you told us what to do, and in the end, we've suffered a lot, and it didn't help us at all. Yes, true as well in Russia was this resentment, because the perception was that in many cases, Russian interests were ignored, be it Western Balkans, be it in other parts of the world. I don't necessarily agree with these perceptions, but and I think it's really important to make the distinction to which extent these are the genuine perceptions in Russia and to which extent they use these arguments in order to build or to rebuild later the artificial perception in order to use it in the argument with the West, portraying itself as an abused victim and now demanding reparation or demanding from the West concessions and not Russia to concede in the places where we see the conflict and we would like them to repair the situation. And I think it's still a resource for the Russian political elites, which they use to legitimize the power, what happened in the 90s to the Russian people. And in many cases, they use it publicly to bash democracy. You've seen what happened with democracy, experimenting democracy in the 90s. We better invest in the more orderly political system, even if it's only one person on the top. It's the same thing about economy. You've seen what happened during privatization and the rise of oligarchs. No, we now need much more powerful state present in the economy, which will prevent this kind of abuses, which is not necessarily happening, you know, because we have a different type of oligarchs around president, but narrative is there. And in terms of foreign policy, this is the narrative. We've been conceding a lot in the 90s. We helped US in Afghanistan in 2001. We didn't get anything in return. And this is now our time.
Just for the audience, when Stanislav says we, he means Russia.
Yeah. It's our time to get what we've lost in the 90s. And if you don't like it, it's your problem. This is how it's shaped and presented now.
Just before we talked about that, just to end on the point on what would we have done differently. Of course, that's the million-dollar question is, had we had a better understanding, would we have acted earlier in Syria or acted differently in Syria in 2013 or maybe even before? I don't know. I don't know what your take is. It's perhaps a dangerous question. Would that then have prevented Russia becoming active in Libya, in Africa? We don't really know. But it's definitely, I'd say, not to be excluded. It's in the realm of possibilities that we would have seen Russia perhaps more as a threat rather than as a declining power.
You know, I would reverse the logic. I've seen that often a success in one country or in one part of region emboldened Russia to try and test the same type of operation in a different country or different part of the world. And if they see that it works once or twice, it becomes a pattern in the Russian foreign policy. And it will not be reversed until there will be two free failures, which will force Russian leadership to reconsider what they see as a successful approach in Russian foreign policy. And I would link to today's debate. Then in the EU, there is a debate of how to push back and to contain Russia.
That's actually my next question. What about now? What are things that you're thinking, you know, what are lessons that we can learn from our past mistakes of not understanding Russia? And what do you see are mistakes that we're making right now?
Yeah, I think first mistake is we should not try to project current trends into the future in a linear way.
To the audience advertisement, Russian Futures, the big publication, including all the trends that Stanislav put together with Sini Kukasari, is available on our website. Back to you, Stanislav.
Thank you, Florence, for promotion. Intellectually, it's very comfortable to project the trends in a linear way when it confirms your bias. But at the same time, it leaves you exposed to surprises and reversals, which quite often happen in international affairs.
So which trends do you mean in particular are perhaps not going to evolve linearly?
We thought that Russia is going to economically decline continuously. And what happened is that Russia managed to prevent this decline. Although economically now it again embarks on the same trend, but in a very slow way. For us, the lesson is that declining powers might decline, but they might decline in zigzags. There will be ups and downs. Second, don't necessarily link the economic decline, which as well slow, to the immediate deactivation of a Russian active foreign policy. So it's not necessarily if Russia goes into the economic decline next year and is there for 2 or 3 years, that we will see decrease of Russian foreign policy activism in MENA, in Africa, in Latin America. This is an important lesson for us. Because it's dangerous, it might demobilize our strategies, which we try to put now in action, which we are pushing back on Russia. Second, if we try to look at the Russian past, don't go only to back 10 years. Go much further, 100 years or 50 years ago, and try to find things which they've been conducting and things they can do in the future under the new circumstances using new technologies. But try not to fall in the trap of historical determinism as well. It's a delicate balance to play for us. And I think a third important aspect, don't look only to Russia. When you do a foresight on Russia, as well, be aware where West will be in 10 years' time as well, or where other powers will be in 10 years' time.
Self-awareness.
Self-awareness and self-criticism without too much of self-flagellation.
Yeah, because I get the feeling it's either or in the Russia debate. It's either very pro-Russia or very anti-Russia, and there's not much in between. Either go to Moscow and talk to Putin or...
Yeah, I think the problem with the world without Russia was that we exaggerated Russian weaknesses, and we haven't seen and questioned under which circumstances they can reverse the trend. And second, what are the strengths? Every political actor has weaknesses and strengths. And I think we've neglected what would be the strong element of Russian foreign policy.
Which brings me back to us, because I think we wanted that. We wanted Russia to be a weak power. We wanted to not make a return, you know, to the status that the Soviet Union.
I think a bit yes and a big no. We didn't want to have a weak Russia, because the whole debate about world without Russia was generated by the fear in the West of what weak Russia might mean for us. You remember a lot of discussion. What if some nuclear weapons will disappear from Russia? What if organized crime will be exported from Russia? What if Russia collapses economically? What if Russia disintegrates as a state? So the discussion about world without Russia was generated by our fears about weak Russia. And you remember all these movies in Hollywood about how nuclear weapons are disappeared, and when U.S. Army officers are trying to trace them back and find and prevent the terrorist act, you know?
Yes, and films about the Russian mafia.
Exactly. So it was not only on the level of political leadership, it was on the level of pop culture. It later migrated on the level of pop culture and producing all these interesting movies. So I would say no, West was not interested in weak Russia. And West actually was interested in the Russia which is part of system, which plays by the rules.
Exactly. That's actually a quote from the Global Trends Report from the National Intelligence Council. Can't remember the exact wording, but basically that Russia is weak geopolitically and embedded in the multilateral system. So basically, was the expectation or the hope, was that wishful thinking that Russia becomes, I don't know, let's say the Jordan of Eastern Europe?
I think Western interests were very well defined. West wanted Russia to pump oil and gas in order to meet the demand of Western economies. And world without Russia, the concern was that Russia will not be able to produce as much oil and gas as West needs. Second, there was interest for Russia to be on our side to counterbalance rising China. And in this scenario, world without Russia, the concern was that Russia would be too weak to help us to counterbalance China. And then in the 90s, there were still hopes that Russia can be powerful enough in order to guarantee and ensure some order in the immediate neighborhood. And under the world without Russia scenario is that Russia is not be able to police the neighborhood to ensure minimal order there. And then it means that West will have to step in much more. And then situation today is different. And we've seen how Russia played these fears. They are able to pump much more oil and gas, but they use it as a lever. No, they didn't want to join us to counterbalance Russia. They opted to join a more powerful rising actor. and to derive political and economic and military benefits. And third, Russia regained the influence in the post-Soviet region, however, didn't become a hegemon, because now it has to share this neighborhood with plenty of other actors, China and Turkey included.
Well, to not leave our audience completely under the impression that foresight always goes wrong, let me just quote also an article from Le Monde, January 2000, that clearly says that the West should wake up from its illusion that Russia will become a great democracy, and instead that it is clear that Russian ambitions do not coincide with Western interests. So some people did get it right, but let's just say that there was kind of a tendency to get it wrong.
I hope that in our paper, Russia Futures, we got something right as well, but we will be able to reevaluate it 10 years down the road.
We'll have this conversation in 10 years.
Agree.
Thank you, Stanislav, for joining me today. Thanks to you for listening to us, and join us again next week for another podcast in a series.